It's Saturday, April 22nd. You are listening to LA Podcast, episode 227. We are living in a post-blue check society. Scott Frazier, Alyssa Walker, Rachel Reyes. How are you both?
I'm check free. Check free, Scott.
That's good to know.
My pain.
Don't give them that $8.
My pain has finally been resolved.
A pain shared by pretty much everyone of note on the platform besides Stephen King, who Elon Musk, famous for his wit, decided to extend a free Twitter Blue to, honestly, this guy. And I have no stake in this anymore. I'm not on the... Just everybody who's still on Twitter, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what you're waiting for. If you're waiting for him to launch a giant rocket that explodes over your house.
That's coming soon. Somebody was like, I would rather pay...
Ride the super heavy rocket to hell.
I mean, I do think it's like... Yeah, is SpaceX becoming like Tesla, that it's like just going to start crashing all the time?
Yeah.
But somebody was like, I'd rather get in a car accident than pay $8 for a check. And somebody was like, yeah, he does that too. He offers that as well. That's free.
One of the many services. We have a lot to talk about today. And I do definitely want to make sure that we kick off with our LA stories. Does anyone have a burning desire to go first? Rachel, you
sure.
want to go?
Yeah. Speaking of ice cream, which we have spent a lot of time talking about, Scott, my LA
like 80
story,
degrees as we're recording this.
Yeah, it's still hot, by the way, in my apartment because we're second floor, so the heat will stay here until tomorrow morning. I want to shout out Wanderlust Creamery. In full disclosure, my sister is their district manager, but I am not a sweet person.
Ron Con.
Yes, not sponsored. This is fully,
hashtag ad.
Fully earned
We're
media.
Joking. It's not an ad.
Not an ad. But I am
fully
not a sweet person.
Media.
Ooh, churned media.
I'm sorry.
Is that the title of the episode? Maybe it's churned media, Alyssa. Anyway, yes, I am not a sweets gal, but Wanderlust did a collaboration with Base, and they created three flavors of ice cream, and I got to sample all three and loved all of them and really surprised myself because I would rather have a bowl of pasta or a plate of fries to celebrate whatever life brings. But I was so surprised that I liked this ice cream. So if you are in LA,
what was the
go
good
to
Wanderlust.
My personal favorite is honeydew. And it's this like gorgeous chartreuse color. It's just a hint of lime instead of lemon, which I love. Just very, very good. So go get your ice cream. Support local businesses. You know, all that good stuff. It was very yummy.
You said, speaking of ice cream, I think that was before we started recording, but we've been talking about ice cream for about half an hour prior to the start of this episode. Because I am a cream fiend and just gotta have it. So, I've been looking for my new spot in my new neighborhood over here in Sherman Oaks. I guess I'll do my LA story next. I have just been sort of like settling into new routines, checking out new places. We have a lot of, honestly, I mentioned it last episode, amount of stuff that we have within walking distance is sort of certainly not in keeping with the reputation for walkability of much of the valley. However, what I will say is that just like as I'm getting used to going, for example, to the library, to the grocery store, first of all, it is weird living in what is frankly like, what is the opposite of a food desert?
Oasis?
A food oasis where I'm like,
there's so many grocery stores by your house. Like, it is really, it's too much.
It's a bit.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah. Just the grocery store situation alone is taking me some time to get used to. But yeah, walking to places, although there are a lot of things that are within walking distance, certainly, like, man, the infrastructure is not built for people on foot at all. And just like walking to, I keep using this example of the Sherman Oaks Library. It's wild because you'll just cut through a nice suburban neighborhood and the sidewalks just disappear. And it's not like in my old neighborhood or around like the Silver Lake Reservoir, where it's like gradually over time, part of a hill fell down over the sidewalk and the city just never bothered to do anything about it, which is the case in a surprising amount of the LA basin. But instead, it's like these people have these single family homes and they've just been like allowed to grow their front lawns out to the literal edge of the street. So they've got a nice little grass and hedgerow situation that's not at all drought friendly. And meanwhile, I'm walking with my toddler in the middle of Moore Park. Thanks for that. So it is taking some getting used to. I do, I absolutely love the area. I love the proximity that we have to some really nice parks and things. And I think what I have learned in the last however many weeks it's been since we recorded is that you can do a seesaw as an adult with a toddler who is not at all contributing to the seesawing. But it is very painful and tiring. And I think, you know, I have just incredible quad strength now because I'm the big kid on the jungle gym, just swatting people off of monkey bars and seesawing and all the rest. So that's my life now. I am a playground bully. And it's actually a smooth transition for me. Left social media bullying. Now I'm doing it
back
IRL.
To real life. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And like, what a metaphor for parenting, the one way seesaw.
Alyssa, what do you got?
I guess I can like build off of both those. First of all, tell your sister, Rachel, that Wanderlust was the last thing I ate before I went into labor with my youngest. So it's a good birth inducer if you need to.
The one in Atwater?
If you need. No, it was at Smorgasbord. Is that how you say it? Smorgasbord? Yeah. Smorgasbord. And it was the like the purple ube flavor.
We were just talking about ube ice cream.
Yes, we were.
By the way,
need to have that baby. Get yourself some scoops.
Two things. One, what an incredible plug. If you eat this ice cream, you will give birth.
You'll lose your plug, actually. Go on.
And second of all,
it's not that kind of show.
Yeah, you can't talk about your mucus
real
plug
sure
on
the media.
LA Podcast. that one's off limits. And second of all, I think all three of those pronunciations were wrong. I think you had three incorrect pronunciations.
Smorgasbord.
Yeah, keep going.
They still have Smorgasbord.
Oh,
is it a
U? Yeah, it's a berg.
I've never said it out loud. It's one of those things.
I don't think you're supposed to say it out
loud.
No, frankly.
never say it out loud. Just tweet it. But not with a blue check. Incorporating the ice cream and having to go places with your kids and terrible infrastructure. We went to Ciclavia on Sunday.
Speaking of.
Which was So great. Wow. It was mid-city.
Absolutely ether.
I got it. We went to, it was like a Pico Union to mid-city, kind of on Venice. And it was great. Like so many fun people, beautiful, weird architecture to look at. But we decided to ride our bikes there as a family, all four of us on our, each on our own bike from our house, which is about 1.8 miles from the route. And it was absolutely fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
There were some streets that were okay. There were some places we had to walk our bikes, all of us on the sidewalk, not just the kids. Like, we all had to get off our bikes and walk. And there were some tears. And man, it's just like the gulf between...
Were they tears for fears?
There were some screams and... I think just anxiety, but everyone was okay and they did really good and they had a good time. It was fine. But I think like the gulf between what Ciclovia provides and the actual real life experience of every day that's not a temporary situation is getting wider and scarier. I mean, obviously traffic deaths went up last year by a lot. We can all feel like the abandonment on our streets. It's just like trash and trees are dead and there are, you know, cars that are maybe going a little bit faster than they used to before the pandemic on emptier streets.
And they're heavier on average.
And they, everybody bought a new SUV during lockdown.
Every year, the average car is just getting heavier.
I was just writing about that today. It is, yeah, 22%. Yeah, 20, exactly. Everybody spent their stimulus checks on a new F-150 Lightning.
Yeah, you've heard of Tears for Fears, but have you heard of Stimmies for Hemis?
Well, yeah, and then we now have all this, the you know, federal tax credit, most of them are SUVs that you can get for electric cars. So that is, so we are subsidizing this. But anyway, I kind of got sad. I don't know. Like I was really happy to be there and see our friends and ride around and so proud of my kids for being these like independent, very confident riders, but they shouldn't have to be.
Right.
They should not have to be. We should be able to get north to south. We should be able to get 1.8 miles from our house on our bikes without having to get off of our bikes and walk our bikes on the sidewalk. I mean, what are we doing here? I would say we're further behind than we were when Ciclovia started in 2010. Like we were doing better back then when it came to riding around.
How long has it been since we had a mayor who was hit by a car while he was on his bike?
I mean,
that's what it takes to get anything changed.
That's what it takes.
But I you actually want that's
wow, our mayor says she likes to ride her bike, which is a difference from the last mayor. This mayor says that she rides her bike and she wants it to be safer. He's never said that.
It is not at all out of the question that the FBI is now on their way to Alyssa's house.
I told Villaraigosa that I was glad he got hit by a car, and he laughed a lot. Like, he thought that was very funny. I told him to his face.
I like just hearing, though, that the gulf is getting wider. It's one of those things that you don't really think about, and yet it feels so very true. Like, between those... you know, the what are now quite frequent closed streets events in small parts of the town. But then every other day or in every other part of town, it's getting worse. And we come back to like something that we talked a lot about on this show, which is that like you had this sort of back to basics agenda, so-called under Garcetti, that never really went anywhere meaningful, regardless of what the silly little triumphal plaque underneath his Obama-esque portrait in City Hall might say. But it was always like a good idea and a needed thing. And now it's like, okay, well, we didn't do that. And also everything else has gotten worse in the meantime. So grim. Thanks, Eric.
Can I just say one thing about the portrait? Just, I know this is
awesome.
There's a lot more than one thing to say about the portrait.
But just as an art historian, it deeply bothers me that that Eric Garcetti is trying to rewrite his history so soon after leaving office to imply that he is like Obama. And even if you like strip away all of the valid criticisms of Obama, like the two could not be any more different. And it just bothers me as an art historian. Once again, in thousands of years, people might see those two and students might be asked to compare them and compare their legacies. And that's just not fair. And it bothers me. That's all I have to say about portraits for now.
First of all, the gloves come off. I was not expecting, as an art historian, to be the first words out of your mouth. That fucking KO'd. Second of all, I completely agree. And I was thinking, oh man, here, let me crack my knuckles. As a Roman classicist, I was thinking about the, there are all over Europe and like near Asia and whatever, that's a problematic term, Turkey and that entire area of the world, there are these old triumphal monuments where you have, it'll be like, the Roman Third Legion was here and mm-hmm. we came, we were extremely great. We encountered a bunch of like local barbarians and we killed all of them.
Yeah.
And it's so crazy to just see the modern version of that, just like giant thumbs up by me, edited by me, for me. And like, yeah, like you said, like 1,000 mm-hmm. years from now, just like none of the context remains. You just have a plaque by Eric Garcetti saying, I fixed everything and then mm-hmm. I left. Like, it's crazy.
Also, like, Karen Bass is going to have like a normal portrait and it's going to be like in 100 years, you'll be looking through the thing and they'll be like, what happened here? And we'll be like, oh, how much time do you have?
Okay, well, we as much as I would love to do a full episode digging into this Shepherd Fairey portrait, we really can't. I mean, we could, but we're not going to. Let's talk about the recent election. Rachel, what do you think about how things played out in CD6? Tell everyone what the results were.
Yes. So we obviously wanted to revisit a few things from our last episode that we talked about that have now been like almost resolved for some people. So for the CD6, we have two candidates going to a runoff. We have Imelda Padilla and we also have Marissa Alcaraz, top two advancing to our election. And the numbers weren't as high as anyone would have wanted them to be. We had 11.4% of voters who actually did turn out to vote. Over 100,000 people were mailed a ballot directly to their mailboxes at their homes. And sadly, only 12,638 were actually returned. Not great.
Shout out to John Regardi, who called the low turnout a, quote, big ouchie for democracy, end quote.
Well, sure. It was an ouchie. It was an ouchie. That's the easiest way to describe it. But it's also like, I think to kind of what I was saying and what I've said to you both privately and to friends is like, I don't feel like any of the candidates were really, I'm the anti-Nuri. This is why you should vote for me. Like, again, the whole reason that she's not in office is because she's a bigoted racist. So why did people not lead with, this is how I'm different? And I think that's reflected in the low turnout. Like, if you're not giving me a reason to take the day off of work or to sit in my home and fill out this ballot, like, voting does take time. I know that, like, yes, it is technically simple, but it's like, it's effort. And I think that Mm-hmm. Even taking time to fill out the ballot that is mailed to your home is effort, and every vote has to be earned. And I don't feel like the top two people are great. I don't think one is better than the other. I think both are very typical, standard, run-of-the-mill Democrats. It rubs me the wrong way that they're being called progressive in the LA Times and in other outlets. They're not progressive. They're just Democrats. Just call them that, please. I'm begging you.
The word is getting thrown around a lot lately.
Like, yeah, it means also anything like far you want. Left.
Yeah, they can both mean whatever you want.
Adam Schiff is being called a progressive by the LA Times in the race to replace Dianne Feinstein, which is kind of like, what the fuck? What does this mean? I think that what's crazy is that we're in a situation where the right has, and like, okay, so even if we went back 10, 15 years, like if we went back to the end of Bush 2 years, the right was accelerating so far to the right, but it wasn't, it was having an impact on like civil liberties both here and abroad, but it was not like to the same extent where now we're seeing just like a rapid undoing of all of these rights that have been enjoyed here. Obviously, things started like down that path a long time ago with the Patriot Act and Casey even and like stuff like that. But like now it's like we've gone so far backwards that you can get called progressive by being somebody in favor of like the 2015 status quo or something like that. Like, mm-hmm. like Adam Schiff basically, right? Like somebody who voted for the Patriot Act, somebody who voted for the Iraq War military
authorization. Somebody who voted against socialism recently.
Somebody who voted against socialism. Like you can do all of those things.
Well, I agree
and like
with
you're
that.
Progressive just because you Okay, sorry. That's I didn't mean fine. It. Whatever. Let's hone back in. I'm off on a tangent. But yeah, you're right. Like to suggest that there's, and I think like within the very narrow perspective of what City Hall is actually capable of, the whether or not you're a progressive, I think pretty clearly is a question of whether or not you would be aligned with the progressive bloc such as it is in City Hall. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that either of these two people would be expected to be.
Nope.
Well, like, where do they fit in on the spectrum of the council, the existing council? This is what we were trying to figure out. It's like, which way will the votes go? I think they're both going to skew to the right. And I mean, I also, again, like, I think Rachel mentioned this or had it written down. It's just like the ability to make this a mandate on how the city wasn't working for you didn't seem to be utilized. But again, where are the deep inroads for organizing in the deep valley, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of work to do as actual progressive organizations,
right.
Which mm-hmm. I'm not somebody who was knocking on doors, and I'm so happy that people were doing that. But mm-hmm. It needs to be a time to look in the mirror and say, you know, I'm sure there was some really great work that was done, but it's a shame because now we've also know that we're not going to get another council member for another district where we had kind of an open situation.
What do you two think was like the story of this election? Rachel, it sounded like for you, the story is that failure to like actually distance oneself from Nuri and make the election about a clean break from the history of representation. Is that right?
Yeah. And I thank you, Alyssa, for saying that because I do not want to discredit the work of the progressive candidates and more progressive candidates who did knock doors and canvass. I did not do any of that. I'm from CD6. I don't live there anymore. I don't know that area, frankly, as much as I did when I was growing up. So I do want to thank all of the organizers that did get out and knock doors for their preferred candidate. that kind of organizing is important. And that's actually what does shift opinions and change the culture and build community. We still need to keep doing that. I by no means think that this is like, oh, okay, let's forget about CD6 again, because that's what people have done for decades. But what I was hoping to see is exactly what you said, Scott. Like, I really wanted someone to just show up and very proudly say, like, I am the opposite of Nuri in these ways. Like, right. I care about this community. I want it to be fun. I want you to grow up here and want to live here. I don't want you to grow up and want to leave. That was my experience, because I didn't feel like it was a part of the city that was taken care of. I just wanted someone to have that kind of love and passion and compassion for their neighbors and their immediate community. And I didn't really feel that. And I don't feel like either of the top two candidates are there. I just don't see that much daylight between them and Nuri Martinez. And, you know, that's up to the voters to decide. Like, I don't live there again. Just my personal opinion. I wanted to see someone that was radically different. And just someone who's going to show up for the district in City Hall. And I don't know that we have that.
Alyssa, what was the story of the race for you?
I also liked that Rachel pulled out in our little planning document the number of Latino voters, which was a lower rate overall, only 5%, I think it said. And there was all these narratives that were just like, people don't vote because they don't mm-hmm. think anything will change. I mean, I'd love to know Rachel's thoughts on if that feels true. But also, it's just a shitty situation. And it just made me kind of just mad at Nuri all over again, because she put them in this situation, disenfranchised them also in through her actions.
Right.
And of course, people aren't going to trust that system. I mean, most people probably don't even know what the tapes were or what was said or care or even know who their representative is, of course. But that's her fault too.
Yeah,
I mean, it just made me like,
right.
and then to have going on at the same time, this conversation about Mark Ridley Thomas's seat, and we'll talk about that in a second, but something that Nuri like orchestrated for her own benefit to put literally someone in there that she talked about on the tapes as, you know, this is the person who is going to support us, with Gil Cedillo saying that and her kind of concurring that like the person they were installing was going to be part of their alliance. And then that deal somehow just gets voted through in council and no one gets to appoint the person they think should be in her position. So it's just all mm-hmm. just made me just mm-hmm. raw and angry again about yeah. this whole situation and mad at her.
Yeah. I've gone back and forth about this a lot. Obviously, you know, we talked about Santana as a candidate who I supported. Rachel, you were a little bit more lukewarm after seeing him not do that, like hard mm-hmm. distancing from Nuri, which I don't think was, speaking my personal opinion, don't think was a result of not feeling that way, but seemed to me like it came more from a desire to want to run the sort of like more, you know, it's not about whatever happened before, it's about me mm-hmm. as a candidate and what we do for this district. But I do wonder now, like, you know, in situations where people do feel so raw and angry and betrayed, to the extent that, as Alyssa was pointing out, that they're even aware at all of what is going on with their local government, yeah, maybe there are limits to that approach, which isn't to say that they should regret going about things the way that they thought was best in the Santana camp. But you do wonder if maybe it took exactly what you're saying, Rachel, to actually draw that line and really come back to and hammer home that point. It certainly is the way that I think about my representatives. I'm not in CD6, but where I have been in CD13, what really has motivated me in a lot of ways when I was in CD13 to stay interested in the politics of what was happening there was that sense of betrayal and feeling distinctly and like flagrantly unrepresented by my representative. So however you do it, I think there's a way that you can tap into that sort of feeling. In terms of like actually summing up like, oh, what was the reason why we ended up with Padilla and Alcaraz in the runoff?
It's money. Like
money.
It's hard. Yeah. I think the combination,
special interest money. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the combination of the Police Protective League targeting with their PAC, to directly targeting Santana's campaign to try and tank it through a huge amount of expenditures, the amount of money that Alcaraz was able to raise thanks to Price's also out of district connections, combining that, the money factor, with the short lead time, that to me is probably the story. I did see some suggestion by organizers, you know, particularly on the left, that like, oh, for those who supported either Kim or Scully, that they were going to get blamed for splitting the progressive vote, which I don't really see.
No.
First of all, I don't think that it's true that was like determinative, even no matter what the arithmetic looks like on paper, because you really just, we're not doing ranked choice voting, so you don't really know.
The goal is keep them under 50. Keep them under 50.
Exactly. So I don't see that even just like from an arithmetic standpoint, but also I didn't really see that many people reacting that way. And certainly I didn't hear that from the folks in the Santana camp. I do think, though, it helps to remember that there is another election in this district coming up very soon. So looking at this as sort of a dry run, I actually have no idea whether there's appetite from Santana to run again, from Scully to run again, from any of these folks that ran to run again, or what would need to meaningfully change before the primary, which is, again, like that's just next year.
Yeah, I mean, look at 12, right, next door, and you have what happened in CD12, which was kind of a very similar situation where you had a special and then right almost immediately the same people running again, and Lorraine Lundquist, who was so close to winning, but actually the first round did win, you know, was the top vote getter of the first. You have to keep going back, but like this, you see these, like her and John Lee were kind of like jockeying for, you know, the positions, and ended up at the very end, she barely lost to him. So you do wonder, that's what exactly what I was thinking too, is like, are we just going to have another, well, it won't be this exact same because the top two vote getters are, you know, advancing, but will you see a progressive challenger during a major election with a lot more resources and canvassing and all these other things happening for other issues that might flip that, you know?
And getting the repetitions of actually running a campaign in place can be quite impactful. I think as we've seen with Ground Game LA, started off with their 2017 loss against Mitch O'Farrell, and then have gone on to run many more campaigns, some of them quite successfully. Okay, well, let's talk about Mark Ridley Thomas. And we kept with what I consider to be the grand tradition of this podcast in talking about news where there was a pending outcome, and we recorded it before the outcome was known, and we released the episode immediately after a federal jury convicted former council member Mark Ridley Thomas of 7 felonies: conspiracy, bribery, mail fraud, and wire fraud. This is actually not the entire gamut of things that Ridley Thomas was charged with, but there only needed to be one felony conviction in order for his seat to be forfeit, which then did happen. And with very little fanfare, with very little suspense, city council then moved to reappoint Heather Hutt, who was only temporarily filling the vacancy left by Ridley Thomas while he awaited his verdict in his trial. Now she is the permanent representative for the remainder of the term that Thomas was elected to.
Termus.
So there, that was a near unanimous vote. Monica Rodriguez was the only person voting no. Kevin De Leon had the, what I would consider the uncommon good sense to stay home that day and not. He wasn't present.
He was like, I'm next, vote. And I'm just gonna sit this one out.
I don't want to be voting for the person that I'm on tape saying, colluding to install in this office. What did folks feel about this? I wrote a lengthy diatribe about my
Scott, welcome back to blogging. I just love it. You. I mean, Scott's points were so good, and it was it put language to what I was feeling and kind of what I was just talking about was this.
That's
like
really kind of
how could we have these two things happening at the same time? Like the repercussions of this horrible thing that happened, yet council is just going to smile and vote nearly unanimously to keep the game going. Like it was just right. Like, and what your other point was so good is like these arguments against holding a special election. And it was almost like they were pointing towards the CD6 special and being like, well, nobody comes and it's expensive. And we don't want to make them vote again. Well, your point.
By the way, your Paul Krikorian impression is spot on. That if I close my eyes, that's like I'm listening to him.
but the point being is, but you said something like this was actually 0% turnout because the fate was decided by these 12 people. And that is ludicrous.
Shameful. It's shameful.
That Cobby LeMay thing from TikTok.
TikTok shameful. Guy. That's a great word. Great word for it.
It makes no sense. Yeah. Coming from the progressive caucus, I see and hear the points in favor of going along with this vote, and I just very strongly disagree with all of them. Yes, I think that it's great that Heather Hutt has been voting more with the Progressive Caucus than with the Krikorian bloc, the more moderate council members, but this is total like it just is completely irrelevant. Nothing about Hutt's record of service or whatever is really relevant to the question of whether or not CD10 voters should be able to decide who is representing them. And you know, you have I think this sort of litany of arguments for some, many of which are, in my view, internally contradictory for why it makes more sense to just appoint someone from the cost to the low turnout, to the fact that, maybe a more conservative person would get voted in or have a better chance of winning, to that Hutt herself would just win anyway. All of these things are there's a sports cliche, right, that some old coach said long ago. That's, there's a reason why you play the game. That's why you play the game, because you don't actually know what is going to happen. If we knew what the result of elections would be, there would be no point in having them or in having a democracy. Like there, it just doesn't make sense to me that we would say this extremely paternalistic body, the city council, and yes, a 0% turnout election from Council District 10. None of these people are legally allowed to live in CD 10. So I'm confident that they're not voting as CD 10 residents. And they can say they're doing it for whatever reason to prevent these people from being disenfranchised. But the reality is they have been disenfranchised. And there's only a question of whether or not we're going to remedy that disenfranchisement the democratic way or the sort of oligarchic way. And we chose incorrectly, frankly. So that's all I can see coming out of that vote.
It's just like, get a fucking clue. Democracy is expensive. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, you know what's another money saver? Not having elections at all then. Then what's the point of having elections at all?
Exactly.
If you all know better, here's a fucking idea. How about we stop giving LAPD money for one fucking week and then we can finance an election in CD 10. It's just like, it was just excuse. And from like our more progressive caucuses. You know, like, that's what annoyed me. It's like, who knows why Monica Rodriguez voted no. Sure, we all have our theories. But, like, it would have been nice, even if futile, to have Nithya, Ugo, Eunices, like, just anyone else say no. Because we know what we know. It's not like we didn't hear the tapes. We did. I'm sure
Thank
folks
you.
Listening
yes.
heard them. Like, we heard the tapes. So, you know, I just like, it was just excuse after excuse. I don't care. Grow up, be adults, like let people vote. I don't want to hear it. Oh, it's expensive. Oh yeah. No shit. Like okay. They still like people deserve to vote.
And then on top of all of that, we had some of those same council members who voted to take away, you know, the chance for these people to have their own, to chart their own destiny, putting up tweets like praising Mark Ridley Thomas for his service and, you know, saying very clearly that they supported him. And that kind of hurt because I think you have to maybe talk to the people who you have just taken their votes away from to maybe tell them that maybe they don't feel that same way that you do, that he was such a great leader and great public servant, because now they lost their councilor member because he was indicted on 7 counts. I mean, it was just another like crazy disconnect to have to see playing out because as Scott reminds us and as we tried to remind ourselves, and I went back and listened to Scott's like monologue that he recorded on the night of when the indictment was released, whenever he was arrested, I guess. I guess, yeah, I don't know exactly what the timing was of that, but let's not forget that why this happened and what was not addressed nearly enough was that not only was this person trying to protect their son, quote unquote, that kept coming up like, he was just trying to do the right thing for his kid. Like, don't you just really sympathize with that kind of feeling, like a protective parent?
Yeah.
And you know who else said that, as Scott reminded me the other day? Nuri Martinez on the tapes talked about how she thought, Margaret Thomas was just trying to take care of his kid. And so was maybe Jose Huizar was maybe also trying to take care of his kid.
It's even worse than that, Alyssa. Like, and so many people I think are getting caught out having like surprisingly a worse take on this than Nuri Martinez. Like, you really don't want to be in this position. Because on the tapes, what she's saying is, it doesn't matter whether he was doing it for his kids. Like, and no one is asking whether or not Jose Huizar laundered a bunch of money for the benefit of his kids. And then she goes, oh, well, he probably didn't do it anyway. But like, she's, you know, she's saying that it's a bullshit excuse, which... Yeah.
But let's talk about, but let's say it again, because I think people, maybe they forgot, because people like to conveniently forget, but like the whole reason this happened is because there were sexual harassment allegations against Mark Riley Thomas's son, who is a grown man with a full autonomy of his own person, who was, you know, in the state assembly, claims which were later investigated and substantiated, and they were bad.
Yeah.
So he's not on trial here. This isn't the conversation about him. But if you are trying to say for some reason that that makes it okay, or trying to, it's not like he was trying to get him into USC as like a Lori Loughlin situation on a yacht.
A comparison was made to that.
Yes.
In the LA Times, right?
It's not like that. And this, again, talking about the Huizar case and talking about like really every major scandal that we've been through over the last few years, sexual harassment is part of almost all of these things, all of these cases. And if you just want to push that aside and not think that there's any other like victims of and accusers and people whose lives were probably like ruined by this, beside all the other stuff, you know, people, you might see it as like a victimless crime because it's just like playing with rich people's money at USC or something like that. But it's not. It's really not.
Sorry, you go ahead, Rachel.
I'm just going to say, like, quick free parenting advice. What Mark Riley Thomas should have done is helped his son be held accountable to what he did instead of trying to remove him from the situation entirely and sweep it under the rug. Because again, I ask, what are all survivors of sexual harassment, of abuse, of all of that stuff being told when we say things like he was just protecting his son?
Yeah.
That's all I wanted to say.
And I, you know, it's such an important point. And this is literally for, it doesn't always include federal felonies, but this is what it looks like to protect people who abuse their employees. This is like
another thread of all of these indictments and trials that we have, right?
Like this is what it looks like to try and protect someone from accountability for their actions. Sebastian Riley Thomas fled the assembly in fear of his political life. He seemingly was not truthful about the reasons for departing his position. His father tried to hook him up with a position, you know, or a teaching at USC that he wasn't necessarily qualified for. They tried to work to get him the qualifications. Like, all of this is, and I think what you said about Sebastian Riley Thomas, the son in this situation, being fully autonomous adult is so important, because it's, you know, what we're talking about is one extremely powerful person protecting another extremely powerful person who was like engaging in conduct that was tremendously harmful to multiple people who worked for the state. Like, these are people that should be protected by our political leaders. And in this case, that did not happen at all. What I really want to say about like Riley Thomas and the entire situation as it pertains to Mark Riley Thomas, the father, I think it's important that our political leaders, those especially who have sort of been coming out and issuing these praiseful judgments of Riley Thomas's career, I think it's very important to acknowledge that, yes, it is true that the bad things that people do don't wipe out the good things that they do. It's true that the good things that people do don't wipe out the bad things. Those things, that is true. And it's important to acknowledge appropriately and with consideration of exactly what did happen in this instance, the contributions that Ridley Thomas made over his political lifetime to the Black community here. However, what I come back to and what I keep coming back to is the idea that when you are a personage, right? When you have influence, especially in a community that so much has been taken from over such a long time as Black Angelenos, there's a responsibility and I think a debt of gratitude that Ridley Thomas owes to voters, supporters, well-wishers, people that he has represented in one way, shape, or form for decades, people who have invested both in terms of energy and trust in his ability to hopefully make their lives better, and also have invested financially. And so I come back to like what actually the jury found so compelling that they convicted him of these seven counts, these seven felony counts, which is, you know, the misuse of $100,000 in campaign funds for this purpose of protecting his son from the consequences of his son's own actions. I think people like Mark Ridley Thomas, rather than viewing them as, the great man with the trail of great deeds behind them, we need to consider them as I think they are, as the caretaker of a legacy that they built in collaboration with other people. And so when you betray that legacy, it's not, oh, you're stepping off of this path that you've been on for so long. It is a betrayal of the legacy and also what the legacy meant to so many other people. And that in my mind is what people should be. I can't tell people how to react to this, but that is how I react to this. That's how I see this. And I think it has a tremendous detrimental impact on people who need to be given the opportunity for uplift in a community that doesn't get that opportunity often enough, frankly.
And there was some, I can't remember where it was said or who said it, but this thought that he probably wasn't doing this with malicious intent. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you can't really say that, or the comment was that it doesn't show that he was, you know, trying to do things to like enrich himself because it was also good for the community. And I don't think that is true. I mean, you can be very corrupt and deliver the right contracts to the right people and make your constituents very happy and uplift the Black community and do everything right. And maybe that was his intention. But I know that they've talked about this both at the county level and the city level, because the county, this is when it happened, but then they also talked about the city is like reviewing all of his votes and doing some kind of audit of what he voted to support and where money was directed during this time. And I haven't seen those results yet. And I sure would like to have a deeper understanding of where this money flowed to and who benefited from it. Because everybody is trying to paint him as this, like a champion. First of all, like homelessness. Well, that's kind of the mess we were left with. I mean, if he architected anything, it was an utter disaster that we have kind of been trying to fix. Maybe some elected officials are not trying very hard to fix it at this current moment. But it's basically what I think the mayor is having to kind of pick up the pieces for, because it was from the county to the city. It was kind of like the through line there. So I just want to see wherever that information is about looking at doing that audit and where these decisions were made and who they benefited, I'm sure still like to see that because I don't think this is really kind of over. It's not just like something we're just going to be like, oh, well, that was weird. There were impacts of this. And before we go to our next topic, which is related, I just want to give a plug to Fair Rep LA. If you are mad as hell about all these things that have been happening with our city council, Fair Rep LA has been following the efforts to expand the charter and discuss all sorts of other changes that we could make, adding more representatives, all these things. There was a meeting tonight that they were following, but just check them out, fairrepla.com, just to see how change could actually be brought to this entire situation that we were talking about. One thing I think we should talk about now as we're talking about these issues is this idea of this toxic workplace that gets perpetuated, despite the fact that we are voting new people in to replace some of the folks who are not doing their best representing us. There were some allegations that came out over the past week or two against our city controller, Kenneth Mejia, perpetuating supposedly a toxic work environment. There was some sexual harassment allegations. These were former staffers who have since left the controller's office. And there was some reporting on this by the LA Times, LA Magazine. There were a lot of tweets. And Scott, you also wrote something, which was kind of the extent of actual reporting I think I've seen on this so far.
Mine, I mean, I really just gave my reaction to the entire series of events, which was that I found it completely unusual, and I think it will only become more unusual that Mejia hasn't said anything personally or given any kind of response to this. It's all been through like top level execs giving their own Twitter thread accounts. We had just like a complete silence from Mejia himself, which I think in some cases, you know, you go, okay, there's a politician involved in, or, you know, involved, but they're accused of having done something. And in some cases, it's fine to go through an intermediary, a spokesperson, a chief of staff. In this case, it felt weird to me because at a certain point, with the allegations being made by two former directors in his office, as a reminder to our listeners, Mejia took office as controller just a few months ago. So having already cycled through two high-level employees is, you know, turnover is expected, but that's pretty early and pretty fast to lose two core members of your staff. It's a bit eyebrow-raising, if not a direct implication of something strange going on. The specific allegations that they've made, though, all seem to hinge around Mejia not knowing personally, like in his own capacity as now the boss of a large office of 150 people, whatever the case might be, of not being good at drawing boundaries between the personal and professional, of not being, let's say, trustworthy to treat his employees with respect. So, the more that you, this is a politician. This is somebody whose job is at some point dependent on their ability to go out into the world and convince people to vote for them. So the more that you take a politician and you sort of sequester them from public contact as they're being accused of not knowing what their not knowing how to treat their employees, it begins to look a little bit like you're afraid of letting them speak to the press or whoever. It looks a bit like you are hiding them. So that I think is why I said in my blog post that as this saga goes on, there's no reason to think that that it's going to end with the Twitter threads that we saw and the reportage we saw this week, that will only look more suspicious. And that's how I kind of think about that. It's definitely a red flag. We had, I had responses to what I wrote. I know that there's been a considerable amount of blowback that has been received by Shakina De Ocares, who wrote the original thread with the allegations against Mejia. Our responses were fairly tame, but one thing that I saw people saying was, like, okay, so he's accused of being like a shitty boss, or he did something that was shitty, but none of this is illegal. First of all, illegality is not exactly, strictly speaking, a yardstick that you always want to rely on when it comes to ethics. And ethics is something that we should care about, both as voters and, in my view, particularly as leftists. This is not the same as saying, like, you know, purity tests, whatever, whatever. I just spoke relatively, I think, equanimously about Mark Ridley Thomas, who is now a convicted felon. So again, like, yeah, people can do good things and bad things, et cetera. But also, it's not true. What is the accusation here? As I read more of it, and as I read Shakina's follow up thread, that there's a clear pattern in the allegations. One that is not fully, I mean, like the denials, which came from the Mejia office, which say things like, oh, well, they're exaggerating Mejia's attempts to stop the PDA and the office or something like that. To me, that also sounds like a red flag, frankly. It seems like an environment in which there are both poorly drawn boundaries relative to what you would expect in a professional setting, and also that the boss doesn't quite know what to do about that, which is more concerning now that this person is drawing a $250,000 annual salary and has 150 people working under them. But hostile work environment, sexual harassment, especially by a superior to people who are on their payroll, absolutely can be illegal. So I think, you know, let's get that straight. Like, sexual harassment by your boss is not something that should be tolerated ethically, nor is it something that is like legally you're in the clear. The allegations are serious, and also some of them are just strange. And I think, like, in what I wrote about in my blog, I kind of focused on some of just the strange ones, which are about the controller apparently having a penchant for pressuring people to live in his building, which is not, as far as I'm aware, against any law. But it is pretty strange and has been substantiated by the office. And so you end up with this question of, like, What are this person's boundaries, and are they as sort of flimsy as they appear to be? Like I said, to me, you know, like, there's not anything conclusive that you can say at this point, except for it's a red flag, I would say, and I think that people who ignore red flags often end up wishing that they didn't later on. So it's I would say people should probably pay attention.
Yeah, my first thought was that he probably can't talk much about what happened, because it was former employees that were left or terminated. So that does probably seem like it could be a HR type of a personnel, just knowing how City Hall kind of operates with a lot of these things and how you can't actually get any answers from anyone on various things that I've had to report on because they were about employees or former employees. But that being said, you know, we've had, again, like this happen a bunch of times. I can think of quite a few people who tried to raise issues about toxic work environments in City Hall, in various offices of our government, and tried very hard to get people's attention or be believed or be listened to about what was going on and try to stop it. So I have to say, to just have this aired out publicly on Twitter, as horrible as that is, and letting people actually have their say and have these written about in perhaps not the most serious way. I think that was the thing that bothered me a little bit about the coverage, is it kind of trivialized a lot of it and focused on some of the things that weren't as important. Because like you said, like, it's not about, is it illegal? Is it not illegal? It's about this problem that keeps happening when we don't know, you know, we should probably put an end to it immediately. So I just thought it was refreshing to be able to have people voice their concerns and be listened to. And I think what a lot of the people who work in the office who worked on the campaign said is they don't want him to be fired or canceled. They want him to do better and be accountable. And that's kind of what your post was about as well, was just calling for how you do that in this process.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, I did see the post to the effect of, oh, we don't want this person to be canceled. We don't want I do believe that none of the people making these accusations want to see, for example, a recall, which, I mean, knowing how things go in LA is probably something that any progressive elected official will face at some point anyway. But it did seem pretty much like positions started moving after that and started hardening, which I did refer to in my blog. So Deo Carrez, who wrote the original Twitter thread, was pretty much by the end of the week, like, I feel really sick about this, had gotten a lot of negative commentary from people on the left who were angry with, and probably a lot of positive commentary from people that she doesn't care for on the right, who are like, hey, way to go. So a terrible situation to be in, and one that left her saying on Twitter that she felt like the time to meet with Mejia had passed. That happened in a very short space of time.
That's right.
And I don't know, you know, you don't really have a ton of sense of where things go from here. But as I said, I don't think there's any reason that we should feel like, or not us, but that the Mejia office should feel like this situation is contained. When it starts on Twitter, you know, it feels like it could pretty much go whichever way the wind blows. So, you know, I do want to say, in terms of the difficulty that people face just in having people believe them, the difficulty that people face in coming forward with allegations like these, especially against people who they consider friends, I really felt like Deo Carrez handled herself with tremendous grace throughout the course of what I can only imagine was an incredibly difficult week. I will also say, I don't know any of these people. I have very limited engagement over the course of the last several years with almost anyone in the Mejia orbit. So I don't really have, like, you know, I don't have stake in this beyond just like wanting to see a good outcome for the folks who feel like they were mistreated, and trying to make sure that anyone who is a holder of public office in LA is behaving in a way that Angelinos won't have to be up at night worried about. So
that's really it. We don't want another distraction, right? I mean, we've got enough problems. So it's unfortunate to even have this happening, of course, but you know, we also need to make a safe place for our city employees to work. And also one of her demands was that we need protections for workers. We need to unionize our city officials who work in City Hall. We don't have that same kind of, they don't have workplace protections. And I can tell you for certain that that the hotline you're supposed to call for help is not the most effective thing that we have.
Every worker deserves a psychologically safe workplace and a workplace that is free from toxic behavior. And I know that it is incredibly hard for people to come forward with these types of allegations. It's extremely courageous. And we don't break these cycles of toxicity and abuse if we don't talk about them and we don't bring them forward. And I think it's sad that we haven't seen some type of good faith conversation with folks that have made these allegations and with the office. But I hope that those come, because our city employees deserve psychologically safe workplaces. So thank you to those that came forward. And I am looking forward to seeing additional coverage and hopefully things changing very soon.
Lastly, today, we want to talk about the, as happens every spring, it's like the
every 420. It's like right around this time of year.
Swallows return to Capistrano and the mayor makes the state of the city speech. It's tremendously exciting. Everyone drops what they're doing, gathers around the television and watches the unveiling of budget priorities for the next year in the city of Los Angeles. Alyssa, what can you tell us about Karen Bass's first State of the City address?
It's welcome to the new LA. How do you feel about that?
I was afraid that you were going to say that.
Corny.
I mean, this corny. Yeah. I mean, well, there's two, there, you know, we always try to talk about what's different from the prior administration, right? So she came out and there was this giant Shepherd Fair. No, just kidding. So she delivered the State of the City address, first of all, in the council chambers. I don't even think I saw Eric Garcetti in the council chambers once during the last 5 years of his mayorship.
I didn't know where it was.
But he would always, he was like, I can't go there. But he would always have these very flashy destination State of the Cities. Remember one year he did it at Griffith Observatory? It was always very theatrical and probably very expensive. And this
he was basically hiding from activists for the second.
Oh, yeah, the past few years. But the famous back to basics address, things like this, were always highly staged and kind of over the top. So this was just I'm going down to the council chambers to deliver my speech, and had, other people give remarks as part of it, which I also think was a little bit different. So Janice Hahn gave a little talk. Kerkorian gave a talk. So this was a representation from the county and the city. This was also, of course, the locking arms metaphor being brought to life, everybody up there. And I also will say the other thing that I really appreciate from, in general, if you go to the mayor's website, is she's loving the flag. She's using the LA flag, which we've talked about on the show before. And these dramatic colors and this wacky, serrated, design, serrated line design. I just thought that was cool to bring back the flag. Let's embrace it. I'm all for that. So obviously the focus was 75% was about homelessness and inside safe. And that is reflected in the budget as well. The other big chunk of the budget is, of course, for the LAPD, which we will talk about in a minute. But I just thought we could pull maybe a few little clips I had a favorite. I was talking about one with Scott earlier, another kind of section about homelessness. And I think Rachel had thought about a part that was about the LAPD money. So maybe we could just quickly go over. I mean, that was basically it. It's funny just to like even see the difference in like the priorities. Like we had this supposedly climate mayor who talked about a lot of stuff about transportation and different climate initiatives and sustainability, and those things were so tiny in the scheme of things. I'm sure it's not much different because he didn't actually end up doing anything, even though he said he was going to do it.
Right.
but it was
so
just
much
kind of
left
striking.
Undone.
Yeah. A lot said at the State of the City, a lot not fulfilled at the end of the day. So one of the first things that I think was something that she highlighted was talking about just how to scale up housing production and how, you know, we've heard about all the strategies that we have talked about, the Inside Safe, which she said she put 1,000 people inside in the first 100-ish days. That was kind of like a test to see how they can scale this up in more neighborhoods. That's kind of to be seen. But one thing that I think was exciting and a little bit different is what she talked about, how we can quickly create housing.
As we scale our homelessness strategy, renting motel rooms, however, is just not a sustainable model. This is why my budget breaks new ground to fund the purchase of motels and hotels by the city. The city must also lead with the land that we own and control. As a result of my executive directive number 3, city staff is right now working through 3,000 city-owned properties to identify those that we will use for housing.
She says the budget breaks ground to buy motels and hotels. Well, we already bought a few of those, so it's not really that different, but we do have it like in the city budget. That was federal funding that we use this way, and now we're like incorporating it into the city budget. So that is interesting. I guess my question was, and then the other part of that was that they're going to look at city-owned properties to identify what they will use for housing. So like vacant land or like maybe places mm-hmm. adjacent to like in
which ties into that executive directive, right, that she
yes.
had a
yeah.
while back.
Exactly. And that in Venice, for example, they used an old parking lot to develop, they want to develop this supportive housing there. So I was really excited about that. And I think that that's like a good thing to do. We should keep doing it. There was some reporting that there aren't that many hotels actually for sale. And what the city has been doing that I think is really effective is they've been buying buildings, just regular buildings, like regular apartment buildings. They bought like a few dozen around the city, just like people build them and then the city just buys them from the developers. And I feel like that should be more of the initiative. Like hopefully maybe it doesn't just end with hotels and motels and we actually start to buy buildings. There's two that have been bought in my neighborhood that are amazing and now they're going to be owned by the city. And like, that's what we should be doing. I think that's like a really great strategy. So that's what I was excited about that, but I hope it can grow to more of things beyond just hotels.
I mean, HomeKey has, which is the state initiative to buy buildings born out of the pandemic. And of course, out of the homelessness crisis, has resulted in actually like a dramatic expansion in the number of city-owned units. Mm-hmm. And like, so there are two parts to that, right? One is the place that we're starting from is really bad. LA was one of the most rabidly anti-public housing cities in the entire country. During the relatively short window of time when public housing was actually being built in the U.S. So we have next to none, and that's a terrible legacy. But at the same time, we probably should acknowledge that this the horrific pandemic that we've all endured has led to this program that I think has expanded the amount of like the amount of publicly owned rooms in LA by something like 40%. Like it's actually a substantial expansion from a small baseline, but still, like, you can't say the only way to go is up, because we actually do lose public housing units. It does happen. So like we have made an investment that will pay off. We need to build on it.
And then Scott, I think something that flagged your attention that we were talking about earlier was this idea of housing vouchers. Let's just play the clip. So one thing also that I think has been really refreshing and interesting from Karen Bass's administration is that she's really saying how broken the system is for homelessness when it comes to not being able to get people into empty rooms. We have this like very outdated thing called the coordinated entry system that she is saying in her State of the City needs to be completely redone so we can more effectively house people. So here is something that she talks about housing vouchers.
So another factor is it's just unacceptable that nearly 2,000 housing vouchers are going unused. So my administration acted immediately to add emergency staff to the Housing Authority to accelerate the voucher process. But there's a flip side too. Another barrier that keeps Angelenos in encampments is a lack of apartments that will accept housing vouchers. So I call on apartment owners, please accept vouchers. Start with just one unit and let us earn your trust. You will see that this administration is doing things differently.
So, of course, I just wanted to play that clip because I just like the part where it says, you will see that this administration is doing things differently, which I thought was like, okay.
We love some shade. Yeah. We love some shade.
But like, what, you know, how this seems like a big deal that she's saying this, but you know, what is it translating to?
What does it practically amount to? I mean, the thing is, like, if we could solve the issues that we face in terms of housing provision by asking landlords and property managers nicely to change their ways, we would
it's
not be
before,
in the mess
Scott.
That we're in.
It always works. What do you mean?
Honestly, unless like a buddy from Elf comes down here and changes the hearts and minds of every individual landlord in Los Angeles, I don't see this strategy making a lot of dramatic change. I do think it's important to note, like, there are now cases where denying vouchers, I think, can be considered discriminatory, and that does not mean that landlords are not doing it. They probably still are. I would like to say, if anything, that it's right of Karen Bass to publicly put the ball in the court of the landlords, all of whom are going to be like, yeah, no thanks. But raising consciousness raising the awareness of Angelenos, of the intractability of the landlords in this. I mean, renters are largely aware of how terrible the average landlord is, but it's good to see an acknowledgement from public officials, however oblique, that that the landlords are not doing their part in this equation. I did also see that the controller's office, I mean, we just talked about the controller's office. I guess I'm going to dig at them again, but had a Google form where they were like, if you're a landlord and you want to do this, like, please get in touch with us. It's just like, they're landlords. Mm. They don't want to house unhoused people. They're not doing this. Honestly, if they were doing this out of the goodness of their heart, I and every other Angelina would not be paying a third of our income in rent every month. They want us dead, frankly. I wish you all the best, but I don't believe that strategy will pay dividends.
And speaking of other people that want us dead, Rachel, you pulled out some some clips about her.
That is a churned media original. Ch-ch-churn.
Let's hear from the mayor about her LAPD budget.
My budget proposal calls for urgent action to hire hundreds of officers next year on the way to restoring the department to full strength. The situation we currently face means that we could see the number of LAPD officers drop below 9,000, and we have not seen numbers that small since 2002. So we are launching an urgent recruitment campaign with incentives for new recruits. We will provide financial incentives to city employees who help us find new officers. We will support a program to bring recently retired officers back on the job. And of course, as committed, we will hire civilians at LAPD so officers can move back onto the street. And we will hire 911 operators. However, safety is not just about policing, and it's time we embrace that at City Hall. That is why my budget funds the new Mayor's Office of Community Safety. This office will build capacity for community intervention workers, social workers, clinical psychologists, and other experts to respond when law enforcement is not required. And this office will organize the community services that break the cycle of violence and crime. This approach saves lives and it saves money.
Okay, so I think, Rachel, your point was so good, right? Like the point you wanted to make.
Yeah. I feel like once again, we have a mayor talking out of both sides of their mouth. I think that most mayors in this country do this where they want to appease cops and say, we'll give you more money. We'll give you more money. And then also look at civilians and say, we know that there's other ways to stop crime. We're just not going to really fund them. And so it's this constant like balance that never works because, of course, it always tips into favor of cops. And she makes a point that her budget is going to be funding the Mayor's Office of Community Safety. And the whole point is to organize
a brand new office. Yeah.
A brand new office, which is great, right? Like, I'm not saying we shouldn't have it. I'm just saying that we should try to fund this office that is going to be, in her words, breaking the cycle of violence and crime. We should try to fund that first, see how that goes for a few years before we start also giving more money to LAPD at the same time. Like, I wish we would just try something differently first. We already know what happens when we give cops more money. Crime doesn't stop. People continue to die. So why don't we try something new, which is just the exact opposite, which is funding services. And she had this great opportunity. And I know that she wasn't going to take it. Look, I'm not saying that I thought Karen Bass was like a ACAB abolitionist at all. I just wish that we would really give a college try to something different. Just see how that goes for like a term and see if crime gets better. Or that people feel, quote unquote, better about crime, right? Because we know this is about how people feel. So I just wish that we would try something differently instead of the same thing over and over again, or keep funding LAPD and then also half-ass, frankly, which is what's going to happen, half-ass this new office to try and help people.
Right. I mean, creating a new office we don't really know what it is. It's a little bit worrisome. And so is the fact that in addition to that, like you said, she wants to hire 1,000 more cops. Is that the number that they decided on?
I'm not sure the number, but I know it's all fake.
Right.
She wants it back to 2002 numbers, which is the year after 9/11.
This was like an enormous part of the discourse around the mayoral election, particularly during the primary, it's such bullshit. It's like mm-hmm. we had Joe Buscaino being like, it was like they're playing Price is Fucking Right with the number of cops that they mm-hmm. want to put on the street.
He wanted a cop for every person. Yeah.
10,500 and Rick Caruso wants 10,501. And like, you know, it's so nuts. It makes no sense, especially because we know that whatever the target is, they aren't going to reach it. They're doing this ridiculous.
Yeah.
No one wants to be a fucking cop. There are people who want to be a cop. And actually, that's more of the problem is that there's this sort of selection bias where you end up with anti-vaxxer, Jan Sixers who are like, yeah, it'd be pretty cool to be a cop. And everyone mm-hmm. else is pretty turned off by the state of law enforcement. So it doesn't really matter. Pick a number. It's complete fabrication that you're not going to hit that number. I don't care about your bonus program. It's a joke, frankly. And also, you shouldn't probably be paying $15,000 to QAnon people to join the police force.
Yeah, so there's signing bonuses. There's that rent subsidy, which I don't know if we had talked about on the show, but they started fundraising to give cops discounts on their rents, but then they have a lot of money in that account now. So they're and one thing that she brought up, and I just wanted to kind of trace this, and then I think we, if there's any final thoughts, but it was just so bizarre to see this. What happened was, and maybe someone can explain this better than me, but basically, Ben Camacho, who was a reporter for Knock LA, got public records requests filled that included lots of information, including photos of LAPD officers. Immediately, the police union, Police Protective League, said that they were information for undercover cops that could compromise their lives, or, you know, put their lives in danger, but also compromise investigations, things like that. And there was this weird moment where, like, Karen Bass, like, sided with, you know, the police union and kind of put this narrative out there that this, like, leak had occurred when, in fact, it was the department that gave the information. And there was this very bizarre press conference where she was talking about how concerned she was, and then the city attorney took action, and this was like part of the discourse over this whole time about all these police officers are going to quit, and it's going to be so hard to recruit now that this trust has been broken. But in this situation, and then the day after the State of the City, she says it in the State of the City. In the State of the City, she says, especially because of this, what happened, the department releasing these records. She did say the department. She did not blame the journalist this time. But then the day after the State of the City, the police union like dropped the whole situation. So it just seemed like this was, I don't want to be like super conspiracist about it, but it just seemed like it was an issue that people made a really big deal about that mm-hmm. obviously had no real impact. This is a very cut and dried, like, public record situation that no one is going to get in trouble for because it's very clearly protected. They gave them the records, right? But it just seemed like it was part of this whole narrative just to include in this, we have to do this because morale is so low and no one will want to be an officer if their photo is made public. Like, it's so bizarre.
So there's enough racists to keep LAPD going. Like, we don't need morale boosts. We don't need bonuses. We don't need rent subsidies.
We were in a situation not that long ago where we were, like, as a city, like encouraging people to retire early. So like, I just want to like,
forgot about that.
I want to like really just like, I suppose final thought on this situation is like, can we really stomach being in a situation where we're paying cops bonuses to join the department and we're paying employees who actually do services, public services, bonuses to leave. Like, that just feels fundamentally bad. Like, we're on a path that we should think hard about what it will take to get us onto a different track, because this is not a direction that I feel good about, and I don't think that other people should be happy with any sort of calculus that says we need new young cops, and also like we are going to shrink the size of our service delivering employees.
But like you said, recruitment is not going well. It's going to be very hard to do this. So it's all kind of fake anyway. It's all just talking, and probably won't actually translate to a larger force in the end.
We need to be recruiting new bus drivers. We need to be recruiting bus drivers with bonuses and rent subsidies. We need more teachers, and we need to give them rent subsidies. And, you know, like, those are the types of jobs that we actually do need to be funding and recruiting for, because that's actually what's going to help us be a safer city. And I wish that in this new LA, that whoever it's for, because it's not for us, I wish that she would have touched on that. So again, I feel pretty safe in my assessment that she is not that much different than Caruso.
But how much different than Garcetti? She does use the flag, so.
That is our show for this week, or these weeks. We don't actually know when we're going to record again. But it will be soon, I think. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Brian Holmes, our editor, for making sure that we sound good. And we will talk to you again soon. Bye. What's the forecast?